This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Okay, so I was 27 in 1982. And it was the first time I ever touched a computer, and this was my first computer. So if you can even imagine being 27 before you touched a computer, but that's kind of my world and everybody who's my age's world, because they hadn't been invented yet. And I tried really hard. Actually, my boyfriend at the time brought this home, and he was really excited. And he got a little upset with me that I wasn't interested in learning. So I opened up the box, and I opened up the manual. And I just couldn't believe how badly the manual was written. And I tried things like a lot of you, I'm sure, do, and just, you know, banged on keys and touched menus. At that time, there were no menus. Actually, it was all command line. And I started to teach myself things, and I realized that I was just really intrigued, but not very excited by the learning materials that came with it, but really intrigued with what I could do with a computer. In 1984, I got my first Macintosh, and that really changed my world because that was the first graphical user interface on a computer, and I was in computer graphics at the time. That was my interest in my field. And so I started doing a lot of things on the Apple Macintosh, and I worked on Star Trek V, and I ended up having Apple hire me to go around to different countries and give talks on what I'd done on Star Trek V. I had done the very first animated motion storyboards for a major feature film on a personal computer, and it's actually written up in Wikipedia and everything. And so I ended up becoming kind of a spokesperson for what you could do on a Mac. And in 1989, my daughter, who's 22 today, was born. And that really changed my life because I found I wasn't able to still continue to work in the film industry. And I ended up giving a lecture. I got invited to speak on my work at Art Center College of Design, and they asked me to become a teacher there. And I was a full-time faculty member there for 7 years. And during the time that I was a full-time faculty member, I taught computer graphics, digital imaging, interactive media, and animation, motion graphics, and then the internet came out, and it kind of blew my mind. And I went to the bookstore to find a book for my students to learn how to publish their graphics to a website so that they could have online portfolios. And I realized that nobody had written a book for artists, and nobody had written a book that just talked about how to publish media to the web. So I pretty much taught myself first, and I wrote Designing Web Graphics, which was my very first book, and very unlikely story, but my very first book became a national bestseller and then an international bestseller. It was pretty much the first book on the subject, and it was written for mere mortals. It wasn't really written for technical people. It had a lot of pictures. It showed, you know, I found that one of the things that I really enjoyed as a teacher was explaining things. And so the book got quite a following, and I experienced something which actually has influenced Lynda.com in the long run, which is that I got royalties from writing the book. And it's very rare with a book deal that you actually earn out royalties. Usually you get an advance and that's all you ever see. But I ended up getting royalties to the point to where my husband and I were able to buy our first house. And we actually moved away from where we lived, which was in the Pasadena, Glendale area. We moved to Ojai, California. I started my website, which was lynda.com. I'd been writing a series of magazine articles about web design when I was trying to get my first book deal. And someone wrote to me who was Debbie at Debbie.com, and I thought that was such a neat idea that I went on Internet, and for $35 I bought lynda.com. And I started lynda.com. It was really just an online resource for my students at Art Center. Then it became my sandbox for teaching myself web design, and it became the website for the book. And then when we got enough royalties and decided to buy our first house and move away from LA to Ojai, we had enough money to start a school. And we invested, we had saved $20,000. And at that time, iMacs had first come out, and they were the first $1,000 per computer. It was really unheard of before then. I mean, the first computers were $10,000 maybe, so a $1,000 computer at the time just seemed really, I mean, it still sounds kind of low, right? And so we were able to buy 15 computers, rent a space in Ojai, and open the very first school in the world on web design. It was before it was taught in college. It was, you know, just really in the early days in 1997. And our curriculum, we taught things like Photoshop and Dreamweaver and Flash, and this is a little example of what the website looked like, and there's one of the original iMacs, and the little folder that you see to the right would be curriculum that I wrote, and it was basically me and my husband, and we did everything from, you know, teaching the classes, writing the curriculum, sweeping the floors, cleaning the toilets. I mean, there wasn't anything that we didn't do. Eventually, in our first year, I think we hired about six people, because in our first year of opening this school, I think our revenue was $1.7 million. It just really blew our minds because, you know, we were one of the only places where you could learn this, and it was during the dot-com boom, which nobody knew that it was, nobody knew that it was going to burst, but at the time there was a lot of money. A lot of people knew that they needed to learn to make websites, and they came to our school, and we had everybody from people from Martha Stewart, L.L. Bean, the Vatican. It was really quite extraordinary. And every single week, people would come from all over the world. There were very few people who would even come from California to our school. So it was really quite amazing. And there I am in 1997, and that's what our classroom looked like. And we started to get, the classes would sell out, and so it, you know, we had this idea, okay, well, what if we were to hire other instructors? So that was how we got the idea to bring in other instructors. And I started to want to create videos, and we couldn't afford, this is right at the dawn of when digital video first started, and we made a deal with Macromedia at the time that if they would help us buy the video equipment, we would create videos exclusively on their products for a year. We wouldn't make videos on any competing products. And that was, and they agreed to it. So for the first year, everything was Macromedia, and then we started expanding into all the kinds of subjects that we teach today. Another thing that happened was, to me, I just really love to teach, and I, you know, whether I taught on a videotape or I taught at a lectern or I taught via writing a book, to me, they were just all the same thing, just different mediums for teaching, and I just really loved sharing. And people enjoyed the way that I taught, and we started to develop a name for ourselves and a following and all of that kind of stuff. So in 2004, our company was, I think it's about 11 or 12 people. And what happened in 2001, two different events, the dot-com crash and the stock market crash and a recession and 9/11. And so what happened was people stopped wanting to travel, and we had to really think of a way to have our business survive. So we took the videos that we'd been making and we started to publish them online, and that started our online subscription service. And so in 2004, this was our holiday party, and quite a few of these people still work for us. We were giving ourselves a cake every 1,000 subscribers that would subscribe to lynda.com. And so the service was 3 years old and we had 7,000 subscribers. We were really thrilled. And today, in 2012, we have 302 people. And last year, we hired 160 of them. So the business has continued to grow. Last year, we grew by 45% over the year before. And I'm going to, you know, share a little bit about what I did bring videos, but I guess the video isn't going to work, so I'm going to kind of fast forward through some of those. But this is what it looks like to log into lynda.com, and we teach these a variety of categories, so 3D audio, business design, development, photography, video, and web. And in what we call the footer on the bottom, we call it our fat footer at the bottom of the page, it kind of goes into depth about a little bit more deeply into what we cover in these different areas. But we are among all websites in the United States in the top 1,000 in terms of traffic. And you know, many, many countries. We also have our service used in industry and education and government. And these are some of the different companies and schools and institutions that have licenses of lynda.com. And today we have over 1 million members, over 200 contributors, and over 60,000 video tutorials. So when we started the service in 2001, it was $25 a month to subscribe, and it's still $25 a month to subscribe. So it's a library, much like you go into the library here and you can check anything out you want, and everyone who goes to the library checks out something different, so no two people are having the same library experience. And it's like that, only you're checking out videos. And the reason why people are willing to pay a nominal fee is because the quality is very high. It's respected among professionals. We have a very excellent reputation. And it's a great way to ensure that you're going to keep your skills sharp. And the reason why schools like it is because, you know, a teacher, let's say that your teacher in this class wanted you to do a video or a PowerPoint or add audio to something, but that's not necessarily her background. She doesn't know all the software for you to learn, you know, to tell you how to do all those things. So we're a great resource for students and a great resource for industry and a great resource for anybody who's trying to stay current with today's kind of digital skills. So one thing that we are is we're a publisher and a distributor. So we make a contract with everybody who's an author with lynda.com. We do it work for hire, so lynda.com actually owns the intellectual property. We pay royalties to all of the contributors, just like when I earned royalties on that first book that I wrote. And so it's all based on the popularity of their courses. And we have numerous teachers out of those 200 who are earning their living on lynda.com, who are actually earning more with us than any other book deal or teaching engagement or speaking engagement or consulting engagement. So we've really created an amazing economic ecosystem where, as publishers, we're able to reward everybody who publishes to our system. And we also have a video recording facility, and we team up these authors with producers. And a lot of people have written books, or they speak, or they're bloggers, or, you know, they're known experts, they're a trainer within their company or their school, but they haven't really had the experience of recording to video. And so we team them up with producers, and that's how we ensure that the quality is really high. And we have things like quality assurance where everything gets tested. You have audio? Oh, awesome. Okay. Should I plug the audio, or we'll see how it works? Okay. Well, we'll see. We may have audio. We're also, you know, the distributor. So we're the publisher and the distributor. So we've built our own delivery platform and our own billing system. And it tracks the royalties. It tracks the usage. It tracks the history. It's got a ton of data in it. As we all know, in the age of Facebook, you know, you get a lot of data somewhere, but that data can get mined and used for good or bad. And, you know, we basically learn a lot from the behavior of our customers in terms of what they're looking at and what someone who watched this would, you know, also watch that. And so in terms of building a recommendation engine. And so we've provided the technical infrastructure, and we also do the search engine marketing and the search engine optimization to help these courses get known. And just by virtue of the fact that we're in the top 1,000 websites, it, you know, shows that we are very popular. And then we also have a film studio. So we have, we record most of our, it says all of our video, oh, it doesn't say all of our videos, but it's really about 90, I'm going to say 5%. There are a few other creators for whom we license their videos and we publish their videos and they earn royalties on our system. But for the most part, we actually record at our facility. We're in both Carpinteria and Ventura, and then we have little satellite offices all over the country. And so we record them ourselves. And we've just recently completed we're still building parts of it out, but we have a 90,000 square foot facility in Carpinteria. And we just finished our film studios there because our film studios were in Ventura. And we are the largest film studio north of LA, which is pretty cool. And so we employ, in addition to all of the regular kinds of areas within a company, so we have an HR team and a finance team and a marketing team and a executive team and all the kind of normal branches of any company, but we also have a film studio. So we have other kinds of jobs like producers and editors and live action camera people and things like that. So it's a very creative group of people. And then we bring in experts who come from the outside. We search the world for the very top people who are experts in all these different areas, and we get them to record their courses. What we focused on is teaching software and tools, showing real-world projects, teaching skills and knowledge, so things like not just how to use Photoshop, but how to compose a good photograph, how to light a photo, how to use a lens. And then we also have been making inspirational documentaries. In fact, two of them were accepted into the Santa Barbara Film Festival on different creative professionals who we interview and kind of tell their life stories of how they got successful in their different fields. And so this is an example of a tools kind of class.
When we structured our table, we added column groups to identify the information contained within a specific column. In addition to making our table more accessible, it is now also giving us styling hooks that we can use to style the individual columns. This can help users scan the data quickly and make the table more readable on the screen. In using column groups for styling, you need to be aware that older browsers offer varying degrees of support for call group styling. Thankfully, almost all modern standards-compliant browsers support it, so you can style with it in confidence. So here I have the Big Sur Trails file open, and we're going to pick up right where we left off. Our headers have been styled, but the table, well, not so much. And as a matter of fact, if we turn on live view, you can see exactly what I'm talking about. Just sort of white, plain, nothing going on here. Okay, so we need to fix that. Once again, I'm going to collapse my files panel. Scroll down so I can see my table a little bit better. And I'm going to scroll down until I find my table styles. And again, they're right here, right above the spotlight style. So those are the styles that we have been creating. Now, the first thing we're going to do is just apply an overall background color for our table. So I'm going to go back to my main table selector, main content, table.data. I'm going to go ahead and add a property to that, and I'm going to add the background property. And I'm going to go ahead and give that a background color of #E1D8B9. So E1D8B9. And when you hit return, you'll see that's that sort of sand accent color that we've been using throughout the site. Okay, now I want to create some alternating columns here, and I'm going to do that by taking advantage of the call groups that we've made.
So what we do, and I think I wish more companies today would do these things, we invest in our people. If you were to come to our offices, you would see that everybody is treated really well. They have nice equipment. It's a beautiful environment. We serve lunch. We have great benefits. We really believe in making our company a great place to work. We invest all the time in our product, improving our product. We have a culture of really questioning ourselves, really being self-critical. How can we do better? How can we make higher quality? What can we do to improve our product? And we invest in our service. For example, as you may have noticed, Lynda.com is the proud sponsor of UCSB Arts and Lectures and also the Film Festival. And so that concludes my story about Lynda.com specifically, but I wanted to talk a little bit about how what we do is playing into the future of education and talking in general about technology in education and some of the things that I see as trends and I think just are sort of the important issues of the day. So I don't know how many of you have seen the film Waiting for Superman. It's a very sobering movie about the sad state of what is going on in public grade schools. And, it's just really sad that the dropouts are so prevalent and that, you know, this is obviously not good for our culture to be creating this terrible cycle of dropouts. you know, the top 10 jobs today didn't even exist in 2004. Obviously, there's a huge demand for technology jobs and jobs in engineering today. A lot of design jobs actually are very popular. And I think that we're preparing students today for jobs that we don't even know what they're going to be. And there's just a lot of uncertainty about what the job market is going to look like and what kind of skills are really going to be relevant to solve the problems that are going to happen in the future. And most people, and this wasn't true when I was growing up, are going to have lots and lots of jobs. They're not going to just do one thing or have, you know, only one profession either. And I think one of the clear divisions is that you guys grew up with computers and we didn't. And so the people who are teaching you are likely quite a bit less skilled in understanding how to navigate the digital world than you. And there's a big, you know, kind of divide between us and how you learn and how we teach. And so I'm going to be showing you a video of somebody who is from Duke University. Her name is Kathleen Hales, and she kind of coined these two terms of being two types of thinkers, people who are deep attention, which is the generation that I came from, which is where we would really be able to focus on, you know, one thing at a time and you know, in order to read a novel or write a thesis or, you know, go through years and years of a rigorous education. This was greatly prized, this idea of being able to be single-mindedly focused on something. Whereas the Generation M, the millennials, the generation that you're from, she kind of coins this phrase as being more hyper-attentive. And the reason for the hyper-attention is in response to the media exposure, which has been ever since you were, you know, born. And just this idea that on this chart, you'll see that among average 8 to 18-year-olds, almost 11 hours of, you know, being stimulated by TV and music and computers and video games. And then you come to school and you listen to a lecture, and there's a really big disconnect between the way that you've been engaging and the way that school is, you know, serving you. And there have been a lot of kind of questions of, you know, this idea of this hyper-attention, and that there's, you know, people from my generation have a judgment that this is a negative thing and that it's actually you know, making us more stupid because we're not able to be so intensely focused on single things. And the truth of the matter is that much media watching is going to actually rewire people's brains and is indeed changing. You can call it stupid if you want to. I don't happen to think it's stupid. But there really is a big divide between the way that your brains are working and the way that our brains were wired to work. And so, you know, there's, in my opinion, what's been terrible is that there's been this convergence of both this media generation and then this huge emphasis on standardized testing in high schools. So we couldn't make anything more boring than to try to create everybody learning exactly the same thing, being measured in exactly the same way, getting graded on exactly the same criteria at a worse time in history when we have this generation of people who are used to much more, much different type of engagement. And so I think what we've really created with such a big emphasis on standardized learning is, you know, everything is based around fear. You have to get a good grade to get to the next level, to get to college, to everything is about you have to do this to do that, and it's not really about learning. It's not really about, am I actually enjoying the subject? Is this something that I would do in my free time? Is this something that I'd really like to spend my whole life doing? It's more about how do I get to the next level, and I think that it's creating a lot of dropouts and it's creating a lot of problems, and it's something that technology could actually improve. So, you know, just an example of all the sorts of engagement that people are used to and making this point that there's a lot going on online that's different from what's going on in the classroom. And then I think there's also the other question of what are we trying to create? Are we trying to create consumers of all of this stuff or creators of all of this stuff? And, of course, I think being able to create videos, create media, create be creative people, create industries, be entrepreneurs. You're not fostering this through this sort of standardized rote learning. That is not the way that you're going to create this kind of a contributor. And so I think, sadly, it's kind of become this carrot. Are you going to get the good grade, or are you going to actually get the knowledge? And very few people go for the knowledge because you're not rewarded to get the knowledge. You're rewarded to get the good grade. And one of the books that has influenced me a lot, and I highly recommend you reading, The Story of Success by Malcolm Gladwell, talks about the 10,000 hours as he researched people who were really excellent in their field and had truly, people like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and the Beatles, and the common denominator that he saw amongst all these exemplars in their different fields is that they had really put in a tremendous amount of time in one focused area, and it was their passion, and you couldn't tear them away from it, and that's how they got really good at what they did. So unlike this reward system where, you know, cram for this subject, pass this test, get a good grade, go cram for the next subject, to really foster this idea that for people to find their passion and then really immerse themselves in their passion is something that we don't really reward in education, yet that is what makes people successful. And another book that I think is worth reading is a book called Mindset, and it talks about kind of two different kinds of people. And she actually did a lot of studies of young children who, because kids generally have a lot less self-consciousness than adults. And what happens is when you start to get a fixed mindset and you're really worried about succeeding and what people think of you and how you're going to appear to other people, that you end up not being very flexible about doing things, trying new things. You have to be bad at something before you're good at it. You have to be a little vulnerable when you aren't really good at something. And that what the growth mindset style personality is somebody who doesn't mind learning something new and is actually embracing this idea of learning something new. And so I think, you know, this whole idea of being afraid to fail, and I don't know how many of you saw Catherine Schultz, who just spoke through Arts and Lectures. She has a whole book on it called Being Wrong and the Importance of Failure. But actually, failure, we have to embrace failure before we have success. I mean, there isn't anybody who just pops out of the womb and boom, they're successful. Everybody who has a story of all the things that happened to them that didn't go right, and they just had to keep getting up again and going forward. And often, you know, many people, if you hear Steve Jobs' great Stanford talk where he says, you know, when he got fired from Apple, that was like one of the most pivotal moments in his life. It really caused him to question everything, and it changed him for the better. And so another book that I find really interesting is this one about a new culture of learning, which is just talking about the traditional view of teaching is really more about rote memorization, and it's not about knowledge changing over time, which is kind of more the world that we find ourselves in today, where things are changing so very, very fast. And so I've talked a little bit about grades versus proficiency versus mastery, but there's a new movement, and Lynda.com plays into this a little bit. I had never heard this term called the flipped classroom. These are two teachers who coined this term, and in a high school science class, what they realized was that even the students who were getting good grades in their class weren't actually learning the material. If they actually questioned them about something outside of exactly what the textbook had said, that they weren't retaining the knowledge and they weren't deeply thinking about anything. And so they decided to change the order of how they taught the class and record lessons for the students to study as homework. So the kind of class lecture became the homework. And in class, they did projects together, and they actually had discussions and experiments, and it was all very experiential kinds of learning. But I thought that this quote was really compelling to me, at least, that the quiet students come out of their shells, and some of the students so rarely have adults listen to them. So instead of the teacher spending the whole time up at the podium, you know, lecturing, actually getting in there and talking to the students, giving them the attention that they need, helping them with the areas that they need help, I think it's very compelling. And I don't know how many of you got to see Salman Khan. He also spoke here. He's got an amazing math website that's very similar to Lynda.com. He's recorded thousands of math videos. And he kind of quit his job as an analyst at a hedge fund, and he started this just by sharing videos of math lessons with his cousins on YouTube. And part of his point is, like, we all get labels. You know, you're labeled as the gifted kid. I'm bad at math. I don't, you know, I'm no good at singing. I'm no good at art. And what if it wasn't true? What if we're just measuring this one metric of speed that you have to learn quickly, and that's what makes you smart or that's what makes you gifted? But really, when you look at the truth of it, you can learn something over time and take a little longer to learn it and actually know it much better than somebody who learns something quickly. So I find this to be a very compelling use of technology in education. And I think, you know, I've listed sort of some of the pros and cons to me, and I'm not against in-person education. I just think there's a lot. We could rethink it. We could leverage it differently. We could put lectures, the very top lectures in the world on every subject, online and learn from that, and then have discussions in school, do things that involve critical thinking, that involve projects, that involve actually being engaged, collaboration. These are skills that we look for when we hire people. We're not looking for somebody who's just book smart. We're looking for somebody who has great, you know, social skills. That's not necessarily taught easily in school, or at least the way we have imagined school in the past. And so, you know, these are sort of, to me, some of the things that I think have a lot of value. Instead of standardization, personalization, encouraging people to be lifelong learners, to be excited by learning, not just have it be about getting a degree. I'm here for a degree, I'm not here to learn, which really, I think, frankly, happens quite a bit. To be responsible for your own learning, to learn in an anonymous way where you don't feel judged by a grade that you're getting or that somebody else seems smarter than you or gets something faster than you. And I think there's just a lot of these things that sort of trip us up in our own lives, in our own education. And so at lynda.com, these are some of the things that we want to invest more heavily in, and these are some of the future directions that we're going to go in. And I think, to me, where I really question is what's best done in person and what's best done online. And figuring out that sweet spot, to me, is one of the critical questions of our time. And so it's really kind of an honor to be in any way, shape, or form involved with something that can influence this mixture. And the fact that we've been adopted in higher education, to me, is really exciting. And the kinds of stories that we hear from people who are learning on our website. And I mean, I had a mom come up to me and say, my 10-year-old, I didn't like that he was spending so much time on Facebook, so I gave him a lynda.com account and told him he could study for an hour every night and teach himself animation, and he's become just so passionate about animation, and it's so cool, and he can't wait for the next class. And I just think there's a lot of positives. We hear a lot of negatives about technology and media, but I think there's sort of the flip side as well. Anything can be used for bad or good, but I think hopefully I've made a somewhat compelling case for some of the good areas. And that concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to take some questions.
Hello? Okay. Great talk, by the way. But my question is, do corporations come to you seeking for you to make them videos, or is this kind of personalized, someone decides to make a video and does it?
Well, it's a great question. We get asked all the time to make videos, and I've had a lot of people within the company try to convince me over and over again that we should do that kind of work for hire. And what we built instead, which actually didn't seem obvious from the start, but I'm so glad that we did it, was we created our own brand, and instead of just being the arm of other people and kind of doing work for other people, we decided that we were going to create, you know, have a direct relationship with our end customer and create something that was of value to them. And instead of being the brokered or being the arm of other companies, but we get asked all the time, and there's definitely a business in that. There are lots of companies that want videos made for them. And if you think about it in industry, you know, every company has got custom things and workflows that they do that nobody else does. I mean, my husband's dad has worked for Boeing for the last 40 years. And imagine all the different things in their engineering program that are, you know, specific to that company and how beneficial it would be to have a video library for them. But what we did was we created an economic ecosystem where we actually are rewarded more to make things for our customer base than we are to make things for industry. And that's very unusual and yet a wonderful position to be in. Good question. Yes.
Hi. I was wondering, how did you grow your online user base when you were starting out?
It happened very slowly. I remember the first month when we launched the online library, we all took bets, and there were about 9 of us because we'd had the school and everything. We thought people thought it would be 1,000 people. I can't remember all the different numbers. We put them in a jar. It was 33 people the first month. By the first year, we had 1,000 people. So I'm standing here today, you know, started in 2002. It's 10 years later, 1 million people. It did not start fast. It started excruciatingly slow. And, you know, I think one of the things that I was really fortunate and that I don't know any other way, I mean, I sort of approached this in a very unorthodox manner, never got funding, never went to somebody with a business plan, never assessed the size of the market. It was all just, I'm a teacher, I love teaching, I want to write this book. It doesn't exist in the bookstores, it's needed in the world. And so I think what happened by building a reputation and actually being a thought leader and somebody who made something of value to others, being a teacher and getting the validation that people liked how I taught, I really just sort of leveraged that. And it was very natural. It wasn't through fantastic marketing or money or anything. It was just really through word of mouth. It's only been in the last 4 years that we've even had a marketing department at all. We did no marketing. It was all just people. I love lynda.com. If you go on Twitter or, you know, anywhere and do a search for lynda.com, you'll read really positive things. And part of what we believe is that our reputation is our, you know, our quality is our reputation. And the minute we make things that are not of high quality and are not of value to anybody, we'll lose our business. And so we just really just live by that, and it's worked. Yes.
Is pirated media an issue for you guys?
Definitely. We're very proud that we're the most popular materials on the BitTorrents, you know, in our category, which actually, if you took away money and you took away everything and made it all equal to be the most popular, it actually is flattering. I think what troubles me the most is when people actually resell lynda.com, and we've found people doing this where they're publishing the video, like they're stealing the video, publishing it, and then charging people for it. It's unbelievable. That I just really take issue with. I think any type of digital media piracy is just a fact of life. There is no real stopping it. And you have to believe that there are enough people, and also it's not only that people are honest, because I don't think people who pirate are necessarily dishonest people. I think that it is, you have to make something that is better than free. And that's kind of our mantra. Like when I look at something like iTunes, it took an industry where there was tons of piracy, but they made a good enough ecosystem so that people would want to pay to organize, share, store, and discover music on their system. And so the onus is on us to make the lynda.com experience better than the BitTorrent experience. And, also many people are willing to pay a reasonable fee for being part of something and supporting something. It's more likely probably that you guys, you know, you're not earning an income, you're students. I'm sure there's a lot more piracy among your demographic than among a demographic of working professionals. But there are enough honest people to keep us going. We don't, we go after those people who are just egregiously, like, reselling our stuff. That I really take issue with. But there really isn't a whole lot anybody can do to stop piracy. So that's our attitude about it. Other questions? Yes.
So it sounds like you guys are making a great product, and I'm wondering about support for people that want to change their own system. So if they're in a school that they want for that school to take advantage of these products, or, you know, changing even the standardized test that the government's in charge of, are you guys providing any support or working with any groups for that?
No, you know, we've really just, I mean, I'm sharing some of my opinions here today. We have not taken any kind of, you know, political stand or doing any kind of real advocacy for it. That day could change, you know. I've really got a dream to sort of start a foundation where we would showcase some different teaching practices, because I think a lot of teachers, you know, like, for example, this lecture series where you get to meet a lot of different kinds of business leaders and hear their stories. It's a lot more interesting than, you know, hearing your teacher say exactly what you could find in a book somewhere or online somewhere. It's a different kind of lecture. It's very engaging to have mentors come in from the community. I think that is a technique that helps engage students more. I think things that foster group discussion. I love the idea of some of the videos that I showed where the students are actually helping other students. I think being a teacher, you learn the material much better than if you're just being a student. And so having students teach each other, peer-to-peer grading, peer-to-peer teaching, I think those are really interesting kinds of devices. And so I'm very interested in personally in this subject matter, but we haven't necessarily, you know, done anything that I can point to change the, you know, to change the status quo of what's going on. Oh, good question, though. Yes. I see somebody over here. Yes.
Oh. Sorry about that. You said a little bit earlier that you should be here for the knowledge and not for the degree. And I was just wondering if you think that the degree that you get in college defines your career after you graduate.
I really think it depends on what kind of field you're going to go into. It's not a surefire. You know, I'm on the hiring end. We hired 160 people last year, and being that it's a very tight job market and there's so much competition, you know, we'll say things like must have a master's degree, must have a college degree. If someone comes in from Harvard or Yale or, you know, an Ivy League college, it's definitely going to, you know, that impresses us. But on the other hand, I have to say, I've hired people with Ivy League degrees who haven't worked out at all. And I've had really great success with people who have no college degree. So it really is an arbitrary line. I mean, I think one thing that it shows is that you have kind of the patience, you have the tenacity, you have the work ethic. It does say something about a person to have completed college. And there probably is a lot of prejudice, especially in a tight job market, towards having a college degree. But I don't know if it's for all the right reasons, to be honest. Yeah. Over here.
Have you considered blowing up your user base by making your service free?
Not really, because it works so well as a paid service. And when you know, all of the services out there that are free, they're either run by volunteers, or, which, you know, they're probably not going to be able to. Even Facebook, I mean, Facebook had to take investors because they couldn't afford the servers that they needed because their business was blowing up so big. You need money to run a business. And I think, you know, typically if somebody's going to offer something for free, they're going to pay their way through things like advertising. And I think it's very, very difficult. You have to have so much critical mass to make. I'm not even sure if the amount of web traffic that we have, I doubt if we were to sell ads on lynda.com versus charge this fee, that we would be able to pay our teachers or grow our company or do any of the things that we do. So I have never really considered changing it from this paid model to being a free model, because it's worked. It's been really successful. In the back.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. Do you consider Lynda? Do you consider Lynda.com to be a competitor with traditional degrees, and you offer a certificate proving the kind of
really
classes
good.
You've taken and whatnot?
Yeah, great question. No, we do not offer degrees, and we have no. It's not in our future plans whatsoever. In fact, we don't even assess. We don't even have any form of assessment. We have certificates of completion, which do not make any claim that you learned something. It just makes the claim that you took the class. So we can track if you finished a course, and then there's a certificate of completion, and you can print it out for your resume or put it on a website or whatever. We do get a lot of requests, actually, especially within industry, to do an assessment component where we test. And even some people who take the video, watch the videos, would love to sort of test their own knowledge, and they've asked us if they could have tests. It isn't anything that we're actively working on. It isn't the top priority that I would have for ways to expand the company. I think, you know, to me, the issue that I would have with doing it online is that I think the only real way to assess something online is sort of like binary. It's like you got the question right or you got it wrong. And to me, I think the beauty of really having, you know, having been a teacher at university level myself, there's so much more that you grade on than just did somebody get the question right or wrong. And it's a lot of things that would be very hard to assess online, so I don't really think it would be accurate or meaningful to offer it on lynda.com. Good question. Yes?
My question is more on what now and what is your vision for the long term of Lynda? You touched about things that you think are important, but where do you want to take this now that it's a successful business?
Well, I would love to expand into some other categories. You know, right now I showed that we had kind of 9 categories that you saw. So there are a lot of nearby categories that I'd like to expand into. We would love to start recording our videos in other languages and expanding into some other foreign markets. It's really challenging because there are a lot of cultural differences, and anybody who's ever used a computer in another country, sometimes the keyboards are different, where command keys are located. It's not just a matter of just translating what we've already recorded or closed captioning it and switching it into another language. It's actually quite an overwhelming task because it's taken us almost 10 years to build 70,000 movies. And, you know, we'll start in another country. It'll take us 10 years to build 70,000 in that language as well. So, you know, kind of figuring out how to approach that and how to tackle that is something we spend cycles thinking a lot about, and basically just really excited also to expand the platform and the delivery system and offer a lot more personalization, tools that would help people better take notes and learn and make things like playlists and combine classes and set up cues and all that kind of thing. We think a great deal about how we can improve the delivery of what we're doing. Oh, great question. Okay, you had your hand up first. I don't know if you have a mic there. Oh, I don't know who has the mic. So if you guys have the mic, just hold up the mic. But there we go.
There's a lot of online tutorials, kind of self-made, on YouTube. And I assume that your quality is just way better. But how do you kind of position yourself against that? And how do you get people to see that the quality is so much better? Do you offer free trials or the ability to watch a tutorial for free or anything like that?
About 10% of what we publish is free to anybody. So if you go on lynda.com and you start browsing around, you're going to see that some of the courses are available without logging in, without having a login. So that gives everybody a really good flavor for the quality. And I think, you know, we actually find, I think, the very top people in their field, and we pay them. And so they're motivated to do a really great job. And the people who publish to YouTube, there are some great things on YouTube. It just takes a lot longer, and you don't know the credibility of the people that you're learning from. So truthfully, not everybody is going to pay for content. But there, if you make a high enough quality product and people need what you teach, they will pay happily. I mean, I can't even describe the number of grateful emails that we get from people who feel it's a very reasonable fee for the security of knowing that they can keep their skills sharp and stay on top of something that's really hard to stay on top of. Who has the mic? Boy, lots of hands. Okay, Mike, yes.
All right, so when tackling K-12 education, would you try to look at public schools and private schools like together, or would you think that it would be better to tackle private schools first?
I mean, I really think it doesn't matter whether it's public or private. I just think that the old way of thinking about education and teaching children isn't very effective anymore. It isn't very scalable. It isn't engaging. And so I don't know, you know, I personally probably wouldn't tackle either because I'm kind of involved with what I'm tackling. But I, in terms of what I believe, I just believe that we can rethink education at every level, including outside of school, you know, because what we're doing is sort of continuing education or what they call the casual learning space where it's not really even, you know, I mean, I think there's sort of baseline skills that today everybody needs to learn PowerPoint, everybody needs to know how to edit videos, everybody needs to know how to write a blog or do all these different things that we teach. So, you know, but I think in terms of, you know, where you go first and what you change first, it's very hard. It's very political. There's a lot of, you know, corruption in education. It's very big business, just like there's a lot of corruption in medical, you know. We think, you know, like doctors are supposed to be about health, but there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of corruption about drug companies and insurance companies and all kinds of things. So it's not as simple as it appears. And I think the way I would like to make a difference is to showcase people like Saul Kahn and the teachers who are doing the flipped classroom and talk about techniques that work better in the classroom and provide a more compelling learning experience and kind of change it that way instead of, you know, deciding to take that on exactly the way you described it.
Okay, I think we have time for one more
question. Okay, one more question. Who has a mic? Mike.
Much of your presentation was on, you know, K through 12. I was wondering how you think it would impact higher education in the future, you know, progressing through that. And I know we do use a lot of online resources in higher education, but, you know, even further. I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Well, I mean, I actually have other examples in higher education, too. I just happened to bring the K through 12 examples. But I did mention that I think this kind of a style classroom where it's people from industry interacting, I think things like internships, I think group projects. I came in and I was a judge in one of the classes here, and it was teams putting together a presentation and having to work as a group and having to build something together. I think those are real-world skills that are just incredibly valuable on the, you know, once you go to working industry. So I definitely think there's a lot of application to higher ed.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.